You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks, she had a pet snake, she bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake. And there wasn't anybody there to tell her what to do, so she did what she wanted to. Everybody knew the story of the princess who saved herself.
This episode is brought to you by our patron, Kathy Ferguson, professor of political theory in Star Trek.
And welcome to another episode of the Mythcreants Podcast. I'm Oren. With me today is...
Chris.
And joining us once again is special guest host Sarah.
Hello, everyone.
We are again recording from the Mythcreants Travel Studio, so that's very exciting. And today, we're talking about characters that the audience can like or cheer for. And I already know that Sarah and I are going to have some disagreements about that, but that's fine, because I'm appealing to authority. This is actually one of Kurt Vonnegut's rules of storytelling, that you have to do this. So
you have to appeal to authority?
No, you have to give the audience a character they can cheer for. That's one of his rules of storytelling. So obviously I'm correct, because I'm invoking Kurt Vonnegut, yes.
Yes, because appeal to authority isn't like a logical fallacy or anything.
No, I think it's like very legitimate. I think that's the whole point of the internet and why it's called that.
Especially if it's Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah, I mean, definitely just take whatever he says as at face value. That was definitely why I wrote a post about him.
So maybe we should start by talking about why this is an important topic.
Yeah, okay, so like, just characters, I think it's very... I think people underestimate the value of likability in a character. And like, they talk about, you know, if there's like one like most misunderstood idea on the internet, it's character likability, because people talk about, well, character doesn't have to be likable, because you wouldn't want them to be your friend, and it's like, that's not what likability means.
Yeah, so when we talk about likability at Mythgreens, we were talking specifically about likability as far as the audience is concerned when reading about a character. And this, you know, could be a villain, it could be somebody you would never like in real life, but if that's a character that you can care about, that you want good things to happen to them, that you are feeling attached to, that's what we define as a likable character, because that's what matters storytelling wise, and other definitions just aren't useful to us as storytellers.
Mm-hmm. And it should be noted that it's not a binary, right? Like, some characters will be likable to some people and not likable to others, but like, in general, your story will be better if your main character in particular is more likable to more people. And like, sometimes you have to make choices that will reduce likability, and in order to get certain story elements, like, that's not, you can't always have everything, but in general you want more likability, because then your audience will be more invested in what happens. Like, an example for me of a story that lacks likable characters is Westworld. I know Chris has seen some Westworld. Sarah, have you seen much Westworld?
I have seen no Westworld, mainly because of what I've heard about it makes me think I won't like any of the characters.
Yeah. See, like, the problem that Westworld has is it's at the beginning, the characters are either robots or humans, right? The robots have no agency, so I don't care what they do. I'm just waiting. Like, eventually, I'm sure one of them will develop agency and lead a robot uprising or whatever. But at the beginning, in the first few episodes, they have no agency. They just do what they're programmed to do. Meanwhile, the humans are all jerks who have various levels of jerkitude and, like, think it's perfectly fine to, like, torture human robots, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, I guess the premise of Westworld is that they don't know that these robots are human, but, like, I've seen Star Trek, so I know they are. And it's weird to me that nobody in this show has seen Star Trek.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it can be surprising how a character that otherwise has all the traits of a likable character can be hard to become invested in if they are just standing by helpless while things happen to them. You know, I think part of the idea of that you rooting for a character is that they are trying to do something. They have motivation, they have a goal that they're attempting, and you're cheering for them to succeed. And if they don't attempt anything, then, like, what do you have to cheer for?
Yeah, it almost seems like if they try and fail, they're almost more likable because they're kind of an underdog and you want to see them succeed eventually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, failing is very sympathetic. And, like, it's definitely one of the things that if you have... It is possible to have a really likable character that is also not a nice person, not a moral character. And it's obviously trickier than having a character that's nice.
But having them be like sympathetic is one of the things that tricks that can be used even if they're immoral. And there's a character trope called the jerk-ass Wooby. Wooby being a character that is like you feel sorry for.
Oh my god, this is... I was thinking of Team Rocket when I was thinking of an example of someone who keeps failing. And I love Team Rocket because I just want them to succeed eventually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even though they're like completely terrible people.
Although, I mean, there are... you can find internet memes that will explain this, but there are also some weird, like, weirdly positive sides of Team Rocket, especially James. Like, James is a surprisingly nice person and, like, seems to actually care about his Pokemon in certain episodes, like, more than Ash does, even. I think it's not a complete, like, mystery why you would like Team Rocket. Right? And like why you would cheer for them, especially because they seem so outmatched, right?
Mm-hmm. I think other examples, you know, so in Gotham, for instance, I brought up Penguin.
Yes, yes.
He's just so scrappy. He's totally evil. He just murders people when he feels like it. He's not actually a nice person, but he's such a scrappy underdog that for me it was impossible not to want him to succeed.
Yeah, see, this is where we get into the thing about how it's not like a binary switch. It's a spectrum. Certain people will like certain characters, others won't. I hate Penguin in that show. I couldn't stand him because he feels wrong to me. He feels like he should be dead, but he's not because he has character shields, because he just seems so incompetent.
Right.
And, like, there's a delicate balance there, right?
Well, speaking of incompetence,
mm-hmm.
that will definitely turn people off to a character.
Yeah, although, like, there's kind of a weird balance there between incompetence and failure, because we've already established that, like, characters failing can make them more likable, right?
Mm-hmm.
But just seeming to be bad at what they do can make them, like, I think what it comes down to a lot is characters who are incompetent but don't ever pay for it
mm-hmm.
is what makes a character the most unlikable, like Neelix, for example, in Voyager, is obviously incompetent at everything. And yet he never gets any real comeuppance for it, mm-hmm. right? Other than in our minds and our personal fantasies.
So Sarah, can you tell us about either a character you really like cheer for or a character that you couldn't cheer for?
Well, okay. So are we allowed to say spoilers for The Last Jedi?
Yes.
Okay. Then I will go with Poe as someone who was meant to be really likable in that film and... definitely had this, like, scrappy, trying to succeed, but failing thing going on. But he just didn't get the comeuppance that he really deserved at the end. You know, he had done a whole lot of damage to the Rebellion. I forget what they're called, the Resistance?
No, they're just called the Rebellion now. They gave up on Resistance.
But they're no longer pretending that it's different than...
Yeah, they're just the Rebellion now.
No rebranding. but, you know, everyone's at the end... Laura Dern's character and Leia both kind of shrug it off as like, oh, he's our cute little puppy dog. You know, we love him anyway. And, you know, it's hard not to like Poe because he does have a lot of agency, but he doesn't get what he deserves more than just... he doesn't even get a slap on the wrist, really.
Mm-hmm.
He deserves, like, more comeuppance, I guess, at the end. So even though I was kind of looking forward to this character developing through the film, the fact that he doesn't get that at the end actually made me like him less.
Mm-hmm. I think this is a good transition to talk about something I called character karma.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the idea that when you watch a character on, you know, on screen or read about a character, that there's a certain amount of sense from the audience whether that character deserves good things to happen to them or bad things to happen to them. And a lot of different things can create karma. Just a character like working hard and striving for something, you know, it gives them good karma. You know, solving a problem that was not an easy problem gives them good karma. It makes the audience feel like they should have a good thing happen to them. Whereas them, you know, making, obviously having, you know, being incompetent or like any kind of moral failure, you know, will make them feel like there's bad karma and something bad should happen. And even something like that was just too easy. Mm-hmm. You know, that accumulates bad karma. And so when you have a character, and it affects both the likability of the character and the satisfaction with what happens in the story. So when you have a character that has, you know, has bad karma, but good things keep happening to them, it makes them less likable. And then the reverse, if a character works really hard and they've gotten really good karma, but they still haven't been rewarded in the story, it tends to create likability, you know. And in the end, you do want to reward them because otherwise the audience is going to be frustrated. You're not going to get that satisfaction. But a lot of the things that we can see with some of these characters, like the most annoying characters are the characters that, as Oren said, they're incompetent, but they're never punished for it. It's like they've been developing bad karma, but haven't been, you know, suitably. Like Jar Jar, I think, is one of the characters I would point to. Is he's super incompetent. And one of the reasons he's so annoying is because the other characters continue to tolerate him, right? Whereas a character that is treated like they're supposed to be annoying in the story and is, you know, not given, you know, people aren't nice to that character, like that you don't have as much reason to be annoyed.
Yeah, and I mean, like, there's limits to that, but yes, in general, I think that's a good rule to follow. The Poe example is very interesting to me because I think that shows another thing that can impact likability, which is very common, and it's contrived conflict. Because, like, one of the problems with Poe's character in The Last Jedi is that he basically, like, decides not to tell Holdo about their super secret mission to Cassino Planet for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, why does he do that? He has no reason to do that, and the reason is that they need him to do that so that later Holdo cannot know about the plan, and then, like, then there can be problems where, because they didn't communicate, things go wrong. Right?
I thought the reason was sexism, that he didn't like Holdo as a female boss. That didn't pan out, but I think maybe it was also something like he didn't like her as, you know, who is this person? I haven't heard of her before.
Mm-hmm.
Not that these are good reasons, but yeah, it's kind of, as you say, contrived.
Yeah, I mean, I doubt that the you know, he was intentionally written as being sexist, because movie makers don't usually have that as their intent. Doesn't mean that he isn't, the character isn't sexist. But, like, this is clearly a situation where, for the conflict of the movie to work, the protagonists had to not communicate with each other. Mm-hmm. And that's a really hard thing to sustain in any story, a conflict that if everybody just, you know, acts like adults, so the problems are resolved.
Every sitcom ever.
But, like, with a sitcom, at least, you know, it's supposed to be silly, right? And, but in this case, that does make your character look unreasonable, because you're trying to do some, like, plot bending, and then suddenly a character that is supposed to be reasonable, supposed to look heroic, suddenly it becomes kind of an irrational jerk.
Right. And I actually think that Holdo has the same problem. Because I love Holdo as a concept. The actress is great. The way she plays the character is great. The whole idea of that character is fantastic. But the way it was executed feels very similar to the way Poe is written in this movie, where she has this plan for them to not all die. And she doesn't tell anybody that she has a plan. And as far as anyone else knows, the plan is for them to run out of gas and die. And, like, it seems odd that she doesn't think that that's worth addressing, like, ever.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard a lot of arguments about, like, well, it's a military organization, she doesn't have to. And it's like, no, she doesn't. But when morale is so bad, you have to put guards on the escape pods. It, like, maybe behooves you as a commander to do something about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I kept expecting there to be a reveal that there was a First Order spy on the ship. Like, I just kept expecting that to be a thing. And it never was. It was not a thing.
I mean, they implied it in that they suggested that, oh no, we don't know how they're tracking us. And it would have been nice if they had said something like, oh, well, maybe there's a spy. Maybe we should keep our plan secret in case we let the spy know. But they never say anything like that. So that's just a fan theory.
And then we have an alternative explanation for how they're tracking them on top of that.
Right.
Oh, right.
It's just like weird techno magic.
Yeah, I think the movie would have been better. Why wasn't there just a spy? Why couldn't we just do the spy thing? The simple, why is there techno magic that appears out of nowhere and is tracking them?
I feel like there might have been a spy at some earlier point, and then, like, through the editing process, like, the spy kind of got edited out, but it left all of these other threads hanging around, and it needed to be glued together, and it didn't quite fit.
That's a good theory. That could be. It's hard to know what happened, but yeah, that would certainly explain things.
Movies are often changed very significantly in editing. To sort of return to slight basics for a moment, one of the things that I see a lot as a dev editor is people will submit manuscripts that have basically a bunch of jerks being jerks to each other, and like, it's not that you can't have a story with a character with either an anti-hero protagonist or a character who is even overtly villainous. House of Cards is always my go-to example, although in the modern political climate, I feel like House of Cards may have lost some of its shine. But, you know, when it first came out, you had the main character who was a huge dick and was just all about power for himself and for the sake of power, but he was still likable. They still went out of their way to make him very charismatic, and he had this, like, interesting relationship with his wife and all of that. Whereas if you take something like, say, The Magicians, for example, especially the TV show, because the TV show basically took everything about the book and, like, dialed it up to 11. But in the TV show, you just have a bunch of characters who are just, like weirdly selfish, and it starts to, like, strain believability that so many selfish people would all be in the same place at the same time, right? Is there seriously nobody nice in, like, a 10-mile radius of the story? Mm-hmm. Seems weird, right?
Yeah, I also want to point out that the lead in House of Cards was, they opened with him being wronged by somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of, like, gets the audience on his side. And then, despite being totally evil, he's actually, like, courteous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of times. Like, he has a certain amount of charm to him. And he also talks directly to the audience, which I think makes a difference.
Right.
Yeah.
And he has competence, right? Which is something that's, like, another key. There's, like, a lot of different ingredients that go into making a likable character. And he's, like, he's able to make up for his deficiencies in one area by having, like, more in other areas.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, you know, a lot of times people will make these very unlikable characters with the idea that, like, well, you know, it's edgy, or, you know, characters, you know, just don't have to be likable, they have to be real. And it's like, no, man, you should probably make them likable. Otherwise, why is anyone going to stick with your story long enough to get to all that cool stuff you're interested in telling them about?
Yeah, I think a lot of people, I think there's a certain character-centered story trap that happens where somebody wants the character to grow, which is good, and giving them some flaws so that they can become a better person, also good.
Mm-hmm.
But it's easy to go overboard and not remember that they have to have flaws that are not, don't overwhelm their character, and then have some good traits so that somebody wants to see them improve as a person, as opposed to, like, no, I'd rather this person go away. I don't really want to see them become a better person.
Right.
What about characters like Sherlock Holmes, specifically in BBC's Sherlock, or House? You know, these kind of people who don't really have a lot of empathy, and you don't really, it feels hard to root for them, but then they're surrounded by a whole bunch of really empathetic characters that they care about this character getting better.
Well, I haven't seen House, but Sherlock at least crosses the line for me, and I know for at least for some other people he does too, because it's not enough that other characters want Sherlock to get better. It's that I don't see any evidence that Sherlock wants to get better. Like, at least in the BBC episodes that I watched, and I only watched the first two seasons. So maybe it magically got better after that, but
it didn't.
But if you compare that to something like Elementary, which is the American version of Sherlock,
Squee!
Which is really good, yeah. Like, in that version, Sherlock also has personal problems in that version. He has issues, and he's sometimes kind of a jerk. But, like, with that version, you feel like Sherlock actually cares. I mean, it helps that he starts off being a recovering addict, right? So, like, right off the bat, you can see that he has at least some commitment to change. And then, like, over the course of the show, when he does something bad and, like, Watson points it out to him, he actually does make an effort, right? And I think that's what separates the Elementary Sherlock from the Sherlock.
Mm-hmm. I do think that the BBC Sherlock, to succeed, it relies on a certain level of audience ignorance about the actual effects of being that kind of jerk to other people around you. And if you're a person who hasn't experienced a lot of issues like emotional abuse or other things like that, seeing a character be a jerk like that probably doesn't really hit home as much for you. And so it's a lot easier to, hey, this is a character that is entertaining, because he is. He's quirky and he's entertaining, and I think that does help with people getting attached to him. And it's easier to just dismiss the more negative parts of his personality. But I think for some other people who have had a little bit more experience with the negative effects of that kind of social treatment, it's going to be a lot harder to empathize with a character like that. I personally stopped watching BBC Sherlock because I did get sick of Sherlock. I got him sick of him specifically because he got too much candy, which is a term we've used earlier. It basically means when a character becomes over-glorified, you know? And it's like the opposite of a sympathetic character, you
know? It's like your karma, the karma stuff that you were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. He doesn't earn the appreciation mm-hmm. and the accolades that he gets from the other characters.
Mm-hmm. It's just the writers really want him to be, like, super badass all the time, but he's also not a nice person. So he's, like, the opposite of, like, what I would consider Penguin, who is, like, not a nice person, but at least is, like, a scrappy underdog. Where Sherlock is not a nice person and is the opposite of an underdog. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, certainly, again, he has a certain level of entertainment that comes with his character. He's very quirky, and I can understand why people like him, but I think there are inherent problems also built into his character.
And I think it's worth noting that characters can have, like, evil plans, but still be likable to an extent. And this is actually one of the reasons why so many, especially Disney films, the villain is often more likable than the hero. And this is not the case for every Disney film, and especially not for recent Disney films where the Disney villain seems to have sort of disappeared. But the classic Disney villain is someone who is usually very charismatic and is active. That's the other thing that makes Disney villains, like, often more likable than the protagonists, because very often they have plans and the protagonist is just kind of reacting to whatever they do. Mm-hmm. So that's something that you can kind of flip the script on that. That's one of the, like, one of the harder things to do in storytelling is to make active characters, but it's easier for audiences to like active characters mm-hmm. because it's like they want to achieve something.
And I will say that also villains usually have a certain level of flair to them. They have, like, distinctive features and personalities. And, you know, people are very divided on whether they like the sort of bland, blank character that's mm-hmm. like supposed to be very relatable, but also can be kind of boring. And when you've seen the same, like, hero and type of hero in every Disney film, the villains, which feel unique, like unique individuals, and they're interesting, can start becoming really attractive in comparison.
Well, this is a big thing in, you know, certain segments of the gay community, where these really flamboyant outsiders who are villains become more attractive as characters that you can relate to because they're outsiders. Like, true, they're villains, but, you know, they have agency and power and style. So they become, you know, like these, like, idols, like the witches from that movie that I'm forgetting the name of. Oh, my God.
Disney movie with witches?
No, there's Hocus Pocus.
Oh, Hocus Pocus. Yeah, yeah.
Or, you know, Ursula, or, mm-hmm. you know, there's, like, these characters that, or Maleficent.
Yes.
You know, they're just, they become these idols because, dang, they're way cooler than the heroes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, villains are cool. Like, every once in a while, someone will write some post being like, but why do people like the villain of the story? He was doing terrible things. And it's like, well, because villains are cool, man. That's why. it's a pretty well-understood phenomenon. And, of course, Disney gay codes most of their villains, or at least they used to. I don't know if they still do.
Well, but they don't have villains anymore.
Right.
So.
Right. But, like, you know, the traditional Disney villain is heavily queer-coded. So, like, that just adds another layer onto it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's really not surprising at all that people identify with those characters.
Yeah. Although it is good to note that you usually can't take a character who is an antagonist or a villain and just switch them to the protagonist of the story without other changes.
Yeah.
I think a good example, if you look at Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, which has a sort of the traditional villain-type character as the protagonist and a traditional hero-type character as the antagonist, you can see they made a number of other changes where now, like, the villain is the scrappy underdog.
Hmm.
You know?
Right. And even then, they were careful to, like, Dr. Horrible's plans are all very, like, abstract in their villainy. Like, what he's trying to do, it's like, you know, he robs banks, and I think he wanted to blow up a bridge once. Like, he doesn't kill people. He doesn't want to, like, you know, poison the water supply, as he would say, right? And, you know, so he's very abstract in his villainy, and that also helps.
Right. Whereas they make Captain Hammer really unlikable by giving him, like, undeserved status, where mm-hmm. they show that he's taking credit for things that he didn't actually do, and everybody loves him, but it's not justified. So he's developed a lot of bad karma there.
Okay, so I feel like we should talk about the great conflict of the notes that occurred when I shared my notes with Sarah on this, which was Star Trek Discovery, in particular the character of Michael Burnham. Because I think, like, Chris and I have issues with that character, because I think for me at least, and maybe Chris can tell me what she thinks here, but for me at least, the issue with Burnham is that she's very passive. Like, after, except not in the opening, in the first two episodes, you know, she's active and she has goals and whatever. But after that, her goal is kind of, I would like to go to prison, please. And she doesn't really have a lot. Like, she doesn't have, it doesn't feel like she wants anything.
Yeah, and I should clarify that I think all three of us have seen part one of season one, right? It's so tempting to say season one, because it's like, it has its own arc. It's like a different tone. It feels like two seasons. It's technically one season. So none of us, we're all talking about part one. None of us have gotten into all the stuff that happens in part two.
Okay, well, I've seen everything except for the final two episodes.
Oh, you have? Okay.
But my opinions, I can talk just about the first half.
Season 0.5.
Yeah, so Sarah, do you have... I mean, I think where I'm standing with Michael is about the same, where I really wanted to like Michael. And there's still really interesting things about her character that make her unique, like her Vulcan upbringing, etc. And I just couldn't really grab onto her or feel really attached to her as a character. And finally, I realized it's because, like... It feels like she just kind of wants to wallow in, like, what's happened. And from episode to episode, she does have goals. But, like, I don't know where she wants to go as a person long term, you know? Because she doesn't. She just kind of wants to, like, punish herself. And that's just really hard to get behind.
Oren, do you want to bash on Burnham a little bit?
I think
you can talk about how much you love Burnham now if you want to, okay. Sarah.
I guess it doesn't, I don't find it that much of a problem that she doesn't have long-term goals, because I relate to her inability to relate to herself, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Basically her kind of issue is that she is kind of distant from her own emotions. You know, she has this Vulcan upbringing, but she also has a lot of trauma in her past, and she doesn't know how to, like, really process her feelings, and she also is bad at interacting with other people. Like, she doesn't know human social cues and norms in the same way. Like, she just has this, like, different culture that she's coming from. So I found it really relatable in that, like, I also sometimes struggle to interact with people and understand what my emotions are. Like, oh yes, I have to, like, pay attention to this, like, what my emotions are and remember how I'm supposed to deal with them. So to me, and also the fact that she's incredibly empathetic, like, she, the whole tardigrade thing, space tardigrade, where she really recognizes the value of this creature and the need to protect it, I really related to that as well. So I found her, like, someone who she felt real, because, like, I also do not have long-term goals, and in terms of the story, maybe it's not, she's not, like, the driving force in the story, but I didn't mind that, because from episode to episode, I was really following along with her and, like, enjoying spending time with her and seeing her grow, and to me, it didn't matter if her growth was in small incremental steps.
Mm-hmm. I did like seeing her as a tardigrade advocate. I thought that did work really well. I think, you know, some of the fear that I have, and I think Oren shares this, is the fact that Lorca will just increasingly overshadow her.
Lorca sucks.
Right? No, I mean, Lorca's the best character.
No. Like, I mean, we talk about villains who are likable. Not all villains are likable. I did not like Lorca.
Mm-hmm.
See, I know that I'm not supposed to like Lorca. That's the reason that I like Lorca, because the show's not my real dad. It can't tell me, like, you know, what character I can and can't like. And what it actually shows Lorca doing to me feels perfectly reasonable, even though all the other characters are like, oh, Lorca, you've gone too far. And I'm like, yeah, because, like, I would like to also win the war against Nazi space cannibals, please. That would also be cool.
He's kind of like I feel like the show actually presents him as being kind of likable. You know, like, he just needs a leather jacket. He's, like, you know, really anti-authoritarian and kind of, like, you know, I mean, we all know that in Star Trek, like, all the admirals kind of suck. So the fact that he's going against what the admirals say is like par for the course for mm-hmm. for Star Trek captains.
Yeah, I mean that part was like I found his conflict with the admirals to be like a legitimate character conflict, right? Mm-hmm. But like I just the way that I like Lorca more than I normally would because the other characters overreact to the things he does. And then that like makes me like him because he feels like he is an underdog.
Right. As right. weird as he's gotten good karma and he's not gotten rewarded for that, right?
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But he certainly does feel like in season 0.5, like he's the driving force behind the plot. And so it's just, you know, it's hard when the character who is the main character is, you know, taking action episode to episode, but isn't really the one who's driving the story forward.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, now that we've sort of come to an agreement a little bit, we're about out of time for this topic. Thank you for joining us, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
Those of you at home, if anything we said piqued your interest, you can leave a comment on the website at mythcreants.com. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week.
If you're stuck on your next draft, we'd love to help. We offer consulting and editing services on mythcreants.com. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around. Tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean, and it made the dragon cry. When he finally apologized, she offered him some tea.
This has been the Mythgreant Podcast. Opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Colton.